these drugs are not for everybody. And in particular, even if they are for somebody, really ensuring that it's the right time and they have the right preparation is really important. Everything from depending if you are on SSRIs, you know, for many of these different therapies, you do have to come off of a number of medications that someone might be on, mental health medications. So depending on which drug and which indication you're working for, we would help that person come off of whatever medications they would need to come off of so that they're safe.
All right. Welcome to the Future of Psychiatry podcast, where we explore novel technology and new innovations in mental health. I'm your host, Dr. Bassi, an addiction physician and biomedical engineer. Today, we have Peyton Nyquist, who is the founder of Numinous, which is a company that uses an integrated model to explore the power and promise of psychedelic medicine. They offer psilocybin-assisted therapy, MDMA-assisted therapy, ketamine-assisted therapy, and psychedelic integration to help you process a challenging psychedelic experience or help you connect with experts to help unpack what you've learned about in that experience. There's such a thirst for information on how psychedelics can help individuals with mental health issues. I get asked about this all the time from clinicians and patients alike. So I thought it would be very helpful to have Peyton on the show to help educate us and tell us a little bit more about Numinous and clear up any misconceptions that people might have about psychedelics. Peyton, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so let's start off maybe talking about Numinous and how you got involved in this and why you started this company. I'd love to know more information about that.
Sure. You know, I kind of come to the space and Numinous's formation came really from my own experience of being a patient, first and foremost, and having really, I don't kind of say this lightly or passingly, and you hear this a lot from people, but I was fortunate enough to have psychedelic therapy save my life. And really that came from a lifelong challenge with severe chronic pain. But what kind of happened for me through that process was in my sort of early to mid teens, became very, very passionate about mental health. I had a family member, my mom actually, who struggled with substance use disorder and got sober when I was in my early teens. And I watched somebody, you know, really dive deeply into their own mental health and then become, I would say, you know, sort of became, or I think was able to see themselves as the way that I always hoped that they could see themselves. And that really inspired me because of the chronic pain that I was suffering with, really trying to look at, you know, what are the sort of maybe mental health challenges that are either associated with this or maybe causing it in the first place. And that kind of led me on like a, I always call it like a kind of healing crusade of this intersection of mental health, physical health, call it spiritual health, and really got me to a point a number of years ago where no matter what I was trying to do, I felt like I'd exhausted all options and unfortunately got to a place where really was at a place of last resort. I was getting hospitalized about 3-4 days a week and was out of options. And because I had come from a family that struggled with substance abuse, I'd actually never had a psychedelic experience before. I'd always kind of steered away from any sort of recreational drug use, but I'd researched and heard a lot over a number of years and sort of kind of as a last ditch effort turned to psychedelics to try and alleviate what was happening for me. And not to paint the picture of a panacea, because I usually say the work really started kind of after the psychedelic experience, but 1 week with psychedelics and I never had any chronic pain symptoms ever again. And that really led me, I was fortunate enough that I'd had so much resourcing around mental health and support and, you know, how to sort of, I would say, live a life that's sort of rooted or anchored in that. But coming back from that experience, really recognizing how much work is really associated with these experiences. They grant you this opportunity for alleviation, but it's really up to you as to you know, how well you want that, you know, it to integrate in and make a lasting impact in your life. And so that was sort of the path that I took. And Numinous was really sort of an expression of that. While, you know, while we are kind of at our heart looking to offer an advanced psychedelic therapy, we feel it's equally or frankly more important to build a solid infrastructure around these experiences that really help make it tangible for people. Just simply offering the experience, frankly, is really not enough. And in particular in North America, where, you know, if you look at cultures really everywhere else in the world, that there are, you know, there's cultures that have a historical use of psychedelic or some kind of state, whether it's some kind of group ceremony, even things like fasting or what have you. We have these transcendent states that are anchored in a lot of different cultures. In North America, we don't really have that. And so we need to make sure that while we're making these different treatments available for people, we also have to make sure that there's a place for people to prepare and to integrate and to connect with community and to continue to, again, you know, integrate these experiences so that they can actually make a lasting impact. So that's the very shortest version of a very long story. But
well, I appreciate that thoughtful answer. And also I appreciate you opening up about your own mental health struggles. A person in a power, an authority figure in this company in a leadership role, opening up about their own mental health struggles to help alleviate stigma that we have, to help alleviate the stigma about chronic pain. I think chronic pain is particularly difficult issue to deal with because there's uncertainty revolving around what is causing this issue for me most of the time, especially early on in working through the diagnosis. And then there's not one specialist for that person either to treat them. It's usually this team, and you feel like you're not really well fitting into any one of those specialist roles. Which was the psychedelic that you first started off with? And were you scared? Were you interested? What do you know about it at the time?
Yeah. So ayahuasca was actually the first. I kind of went to the deeper end of the pool, so to speak. But I went to a place that is legally able to offer, in a country that's legally able to offer ayahuasca. And I felt very safe. You know, I as I was kind of saying in regards to fears, I was really at a place of out of options. And so I think I had some of the natural natural sort of, you hear about all different kinds of things from, you know, am I going to throw up in a bucket for 4 days or what was, you know, some of those concerns I definitely had, but I was at very much at a place of just, you know, a surrender place, I would say. Yeah. I need help. And at this point I don't care what form it comes in. So that was, you know, the kind of the feelings going into it. You know, it's interesting as someone with chronic pain, because there is a very physical aspect to obviously ayahuasca, but really all psychedelics. So I did have this, you know, there was an interesting kind of variable, call it, in regards to how is, you know, what is this going to mean for my chronic pain? And frankly, you know, as someone who was in the hospital as frequently as I was, it was, do I have access to the kind of care that maybe I need if I end up having a pain episode or something like that while I was there? And so those were some, you know, maybe more targeted towards someone who was in the condition that I was in. But other than that, you know, I think there's such an overwhelming amount of not just research, but obviously anecdotal information that's out there. So I think, frankly, maybe more than we need. I think you can go down a lot of rabbit holes and create a lot of expectations that I think can be challenging, but I felt I was well informed and going to a place that was safe. Yeah.
It sounds like you had a very positive first initial experience with ayahuasca. I'm sure a lot of people benefit from it, but they don't end up starting a company to help people What made you want to take it that next step? Was it that, I mean, it was a life-changing experience. It changed your entire life around. And then did you feel that passionately about it that you wanted to bring it to other people who needed that help?
You know, to be honest, it was actually kind of the opposite experience. You know, I think, and you see this a lot in people who have gone through these kinds of experiences where there's this real like volition to, they come out of these experiences and I think sometimes there's this feeling of like, do I need to alter almost my identity to, you know, be more cohesive maybe with this experience? And I think that's a challenge that we run into a little bit that we have to be cautious of. For me, I came out of the experience and actually there was this very sort of clear intuition that I had around this is something that demands and deserves a lot of reverence. And it's something that really needs to be approached really intentionally and thoughtfully. And when I came out of that experience, really what I was looking to do is just give back to something that saved my life. I felt like there needed to be some kind of reciprocity for this, you know, experience that I had. And so initially what I was doing was just kind of looking around, whether it was a non-for-profit or a research group or something, you know, something that I could do to contribute to this kind of life-saving opportunity that I had. But the thing that I recognized early was that, you know, philanthropy just wasn't going to cut it. It felt a little bit like a shallow or a bit of a hollow kind of contribution. And, you know, I was never smart enough to be a doctor or a healthcare professional. but I, you know, I was meeting with a lot of different groups and kind of regardless of who I met with, I, you know, very quickly met with people like MAPS, who people who are listening might know, or a lot of research groups, a lot of academic groups. And when I was asking them, like, you know, what do you need? What is the kind of thing that's needed here? The feedback that I actually continued to hear was that nobody was really looking at sort of the infrastructure or application of these different therapies that were in a research context. Who was building that infrastructure to actually transition it from a research context and into a model centered around accessibility? And so that's really where Numinous was formed from, was, you know, okay, we can, you know, that's maybe a place that I can help contribute, is let's go and try and help build that model. And so we've sort of done that by, you know, as you mentioned at the top of the call, we have a number of clinic centers across both Canada and down into the United States, where we offer a host of just traditional mental health services, as well as psychedelic therapy as well, primarily through the form of ketamine, but also able to start to provide access for MDMA and psilocybin assisted therapy. And we're also a contract research site organization. So we're the clinical trial sites for pretty much every major psychedelic clinical study at the moment. And what that's kind of given us the opportunity to do is start to implement these different protocols into our clinical infrastructure so that we can really ideate and fine tune that clinical infrastructure based off of what we're seeing in the research and what we know is coming. And that, I think, is really important and kind of what we spoke about and really, you know, why Numinous exists is, you know, we obviously have this firm belief that psychedelic therapies are going to become available, but there's a very big delta between, call it just psychedelic therapy, and really well-informed offerings and support that are centered around psychedelic therapy. And I think that's something we really need to be cognizant of, is, you know, it's kind of just saying like surgery is surgery and it doesn't matter who you get surgery from, as long as you get surgery, it's going to be good. You know, while we want to believe that, there's a lot that goes into that kind of an intervention, inclusive of, you know, how well you prepare for that surgery, how well you take care of your body, how well you kind of do everything that you can to make sure your body is in the best position possible to go through that surgery successfully. And then coming out the other side of that if you really take care of your body, if you do rehabilitation well, if you do all of the things that really help advance that healing as much as possible, then the percentage chance of success of that surgery is going to be much higher. If you go into that surgery saying, well, I'm going to bang this thing up as much as possible before going in for a knee surgery, and I'm going to downhill mountain bike every day, and I'm not going to take care of myself. And then you go in for the surgery, and then you come out and you say, well, I'm going to keep downhill mountain biking, and I'm not going to take care of myself very well. The chances of you maybe needing another surgery are much higher. And I think when we think about the integration and implementation of psychedelic therapy, that's the same lens that really I think we need to see this through. And again, while there can be a lot of excitement and volition around the conversation of just psychedelic therapy, I think we really need to make sure that we're helping educate and inform, what really needs to go into that in order for these different interventions to be successful.
I like that analogy. I think that's one a lot of people can relate to and understand fairly well. Let's start at the beginning. Say I'm a patient who has depression and anxiety, maybe rough upbringing, no substance issues, and I've tried other SSRIs before, tried therapy, don't feel like it's quite helped me. I want to try something different. And I'm interested in MDMA versus psilocybin versus ketamine. Mm-hmm. Where do I start? Does Numinous help me and maybe provide a suggestion? How would I know which one to use or sure. look up more information about?
Yeah, I think the question around which one to use is an interesting one. Obviously, we're talking about things like MDMA and psilocybin and other psychedelic compounds. These are still drugs that are in clinical trials at the moment. So we don't have FDA approval of these compounds yet. But if we sort of fast forward a little bit to maybe a post-approval setting, I think, the one thing that research obviously has done an exceptional job of is, really helping define and different drugs for particular indications. And, I think probably best highlighted by the work that MAPS, which for anybody who doesn't know who MAPS is, stands for the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. They're really, the reason why psychedelics are where they are in the West at the moment. They've been doing clinical trials on MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for post-traumatic stress disorder for about 37 years now. And they've now completed their second successful phase 3 clinical trial. We're waiting for the readout from those results. But the first phase 3 results were astounding. And these were people with treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. And what it showed was over 80% of participants saw significant clinical reduction in their symptoms, and 67% actually no longer met the PTSD criteria after just 3 treatments. So really a kind of astounding result. And so to get back to your question, I think research is doing a good job of helping us answer some of those questions as to which drug for which indication. But I think as a client of wanting to get access, there's tons of clinical trial information that is out there on a number of different compounds, on a number of different indications. I think as we look at this, and maybe I'll use, ketamine, which is legally much more broadly available at the moment. But as we look at clients, I think what's really important is there are some very significant sort of safety profiles that we have to move through. These drugs are not for everybody. And in particular, even if they are for somebody, really ensuring that it's the right time and they have the right preparation is really important. Everything from depending if you are on SSRIs, for many of these different therapies, you do have to come off of a number of medications that someone might be on, mental health medications. So depending on which drug and which indication you're working for, we would help that person come off of whatever medications they would need to come off of so that they're safe. And then again, it really comes down to trying to help really get to the root. And this is where psychedelics, we believe, are really effective, is they do help get to the root cause. You mentioned someone who might have a couple of different indications or presentations where that might be rooted in something like a childhood trauma. And I think, you know, that's really what psychedelics are helping do, is they're helping get to the root cause of what is creating that indication in the first place. And depending on how you're presenting, some of the data, as I mentioned, MDMA seems to be really effective for PTSD and kind of that PTSD trauma response. Depression right now, there's a lot of what ketamine is being used for is the treatment of depression. Similarly with psilocybin is being researched for depression as well. So I think if I think about the future, I think where we're going to be able to get to really quickly is being able to identify which drug for which indication at which time and be able to help people through that. But I think for us, we spend a lot of time trying to not just prepare someone in regards to helping them identify maybe where the root cause of where some of their mental health challenges may be, but also education on, you know, some of the things that we feel are very important to resource yourself going into a psychedelic experience, being able to breathe, you know, an understanding of what might entail. Not so much, we're very cautious to not try and explain the psychedelic experience. You know, it's kind of like trying to explain that you're explaining an ineffable sort of thing that is so personal to the individual. So we try not to create any expectations for people, but this is the set and setting. This is the length of time. This is, and then, you know, subsequently to that, and this is what we believe you really need to know and understand as a integration process as well. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's something it feels strange to call the psychedelic industry an industry, but as we're talking so much about, you know, the potential effects of psychedelic therapy, and I'm maybe returning to this frequently, but really making sure that people understand before they have a psychedelic experience, you know, what after could look like for somebody. It can take, you know, 6 months to really work through the material that comes up in these experiences. And you have to be able to contribute the time and effort to really do that. And it's important that people know that before going into an experience like this.
Interesting. Thank you. And can you speak to another decision point that a lot of people ask about is microdosing versus the experience? Mm-hmm. Say, let's choose ketamine, for example, since that's more available. What would you counsel somebody on as to the advantages and disadvantages of each? Or does Numinous do one only and not the other?
Yeah. So our focus is on, call it psychedelic assisted therapy, which is a larger dose of a psychedelic compound used in conjunction with therapy. There's been a lot of conversation about microdosing. Microdosing is still not a legal activity. And to be honest, there's very little research data about microdosing at the moment. Pretty much all of the research that's out there right now is more on larger doses associated with therapy. I'm very interested to see more research come out in regards to microdosing. But I think, you know, again, going back to what we were talking about before, I think the thing we have to, the mindset shift as well is, I think we've gotten really kind of stuck in this thinking that mental health indications are a lifelong diagnosis that we symptom manage instead of try and treat and cure people of. And, you know, I think a lot of that and SSRIs and antidepressants most certainly have their place in regards to helping people, but those are more symptom managers. When we think about psychedelic assisted therapy, we do approach it with curative intent. Our hope is that someone is going to come and do these treatments and actually cure and alleviate their mental health challenges, which is, again, a big mindset shift at the moment, because, you know, typically someone who has a diagnosis of depression or anxiety, the kind of expectation is that this is something that, you know, they're going to have to try and manage for the rest of their lives now. We don't believe that to be true.
Interesting. That's interesting. I think that certainly appeals to a lot of people and gives a lot of people hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think certainly we would want to strive for that as the ideal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody wants to live with anything long term. And there are some instances where people can take a SSRI for something that they're going through. So maybe it's more psychosocial in mm-hmm. terms of its impact and cause. And this helps kind of get them to the next phase in their life. And I can also certainly relate to a number of individuals who have repeated episodes of depression that seem to pop out when everything in their life is going great, which kind of speaks mm-hmm. to more of the underlying biology. I think it's mm-hmm. a really good point and question that you have brought up is, can ketamine help with this curative aspect of chronic mental illness? I would love to see the data on that. I hope as a clinician that it is much better than our current treatment options.
Yeah, I think, you know, ketamine is an interesting one. When we think about durability of the experiences, ketamine does present some challenges in regards to the durability of these experiences. And we've seen data that does show that there may need to be, you know, kind of repeating of those different therapies. And I think that's kind of more substance dependent, but also I think it's, if you look at the ways in which we've administered ketamine, you know, everything, and fortunately we've seen this kind of tightening up a little bit again, but especially through COVID, we saw everything from, you know, mail order ketamine that was coming to people's houses and they were getting very little support, which, you know, I'm happy to talk a little bit more about.
That was my next question.
But also we've seen ketamine used intravenously with very little therapeutic support for the treatment of depression. So I think what I'm hoping to see more so from just ketamine in particular over the next little bit is, you know, the use of ketamine in conjunction with therapy, and how does that affect durability versus just ketamine, the drug itself? Because I think that's something that hasn't gotten enough research is really helping spell that out. And I think we're going to probably see more of that in the next little bit. But the thing that we find people coming to us over and over and over again are typically people who have had ketamine experiences somewhere else, you know, whether it's IV or whether it's a mail to home ketamine product that they've gotten, and they've had really challenging experiences, and they find themselves in, you know, sometimes the same position they were in before the ketamine experience, and frankly sometimes even worse, and they're looking to try and work with somebody who can really help them process and unpack and make sense of, or maybe make sense is the wrong word, but at least, you know, be able to take that experience and turn it into something that's positively impacting their lives. And so that for us is really why we take the approach to ketamine assisted therapy that we do. We don't do any mail order ketamine. We have a very, very select few clients who have worked with us for quite some time that do benefit from a take-home ketamine every once in a while, but we don't, that's not something that we offer really as a service. I think, you know, just kind of moving to that question of sort of the do-it-yourself ketamine model, I think that's fraught with a lot of challenges. And that's not to say that it doesn't have its place, but, you know, to on a more personal level, to me, that's almost the same as like mailing somebody a scalpel to their house and saying, you know, do some brain surgery on yourself and don't worry, we'll have somebody over Zoom there maybe for you. And we're going to give you some information. I think it's dangerous. I think for some people, most certainly has its place, but I think we do have to be really, really cautious with that. And, you know, the other thing that ketamine does have that the other psychedelic compounds don't have, frankly, is ketamine does have the potential for abuse. There are cases of people becoming dependent on ketamine. And so I think that's something we need to speak much more openly about and be much more cautious of.
Yeah, I've certainly had individuals in the past who have admitted to feeling addicted to ketamine before. Mm-hmm. And to comment on what you were saying, I think whenever we're at the beginning of an industry, there's so much excitement and growth that's at warp speed, and it becomes this divergence of ideas, maybe, which is a good thing and a bad thing at the same time, because it introduces new novel approaches to integrating ketamine into mental health. But also at the same time, there might be individuals who aren't very judicious and cautious and follow many rules and look mm-hmm. at profit perhaps, and they have different intentions. And I think it behooves us and other leaders in this field to think about, could we have some sort of standardization in terms of safety protocols revolving around these psychedelics, because they are new, I think, mm-hmm. and we don't know everything about them as well. What are your thoughts on, in terms of potentially helping with address the safety factor and how heterogeneous all of these clinics are from what you're describing?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And I think also, you know, as you pointed out, as a new industry with, you know, the many different motives, whether it's profit motives, whether it's, you know, motives of trying to alleviate, you know, mental health challenges, I think there's and I think what's really interesting is this is kind of this intersection of drug plus therapy, where, you know, that I think for a lot of people, you know, who have had challenges, whether with different prescription medications or what have you, I think we really need to not just provide best practices, but I think there also really needs to be good sources of truth and information and education. Maybe speaking even more broadly than just this is the safe protocol, but also, you know, really laying out like what are the true facts about these compounds, and what have we seen be successful or not successful, and what are the things to really look out for, and especially around, you know, mental health care, as we all know that there's this, you know, I think the largest societal issue we have at the moment is how we're treating mental health care, and it really, you know, it doesn't matter which indication you look at the moment, they all continue to go up. And we need to, there's such a needing or a yearning for, you know, new solutions. And yes, psychedelics are exciting and they present a lot of promise, but, you know, I always kind of akin it, they're just tools. And if you think about a hammer, you know, a hammer can be used to build a beautiful house, or a hammer can be used to hit yourself in the hand with, depending on who's swinging it. And I think we just really have to be cautious of that. And similarly, that goes both ways. I think, you know, these are very, very powerful tools, which used in the wrong hands can cause a lot of abuse. That doesn't mean that the tool is to blame. And I think we have to really make sure that we make people aware of that as well, is that it really does come down to who is using these different tools and how are they using them in order to try and get people to where they're trying to get to.
Right. I think if clinics and practices are too cavalier in their usage of ketamine, I think people can have a bad experience, and patients all talk to each other and they post online and they mm-hmm. talk about their experiences. And I think as a whole, as an industry, that could in fact hurt us in the long run by spreading mm-hmm. stigma about how maybe dangerous these things are now, and we need to now regulate them and make them illegal. And I think that's yeah. kind of what SSRIs had been exposed to and subject to, is this embrace and then usage, and then maybe people have these certain myths and misperceptions about, and then lo and behold, you have a lot of stigma about them too.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I couldn't agree more.
Do you think, what do you think are some factors that attribute to why psychedelics are so widely embraced now? Is it partially because they're not associated with pharmaceutical company? Because I know a lot of patients, they don't trust pharmaceutical companies after mm-hmm. the opioid epidemic, or we're in the midst of it, but after that publicity, I should say. And, you know, when people say ketamine, no company comes to mind, although there's a company that markets the Spravato now, but ketamine is ketamine. It's been around since, what, the 30s? So why do you think it is that people embrace these?
You know, I think it's a combination of factors. I definitely think there's this thing with pharmaceutical companies that people are seeing the, again, you know, where some of the challenges have been, and there's this kind of wanting to try something different or go along a different path. I think, you know, as we spoke about already, I think we are at this kind of tipping point, and I think we've been there for a long time, but this recognition of we need something different, or we need to, frankly, maybe even be approaching mental health care differently. And I think there's a very broad recognition of that. And, you know, maybe more recently, I think COVID was really sort of a bit of a moment for where people really recognize, oh, that, you know, we're struggling maybe more than we're even recognizing at the moment in regards to mental health care. And so I think those are factors that play into it. Obviously, you know, from a cultural perspective, there's been a lot of resurgence of psychedelic use in culture lately. So I think that's been a part of it. And then, you know, to be honest, as I kind of mentioned with the MAPS results, is the amount of clinical promise we've seen is really quite astounding in the research. So I think that's contributed to it as well. But I don't think it's one sort of factor. I think it's the collection of a lot of factors. And I think the one thing that maybe to be considered as well, and it's a completely different sort of area, and I don't like to try and draw too many similarities to it, but if you think about what the role of cannabis and the sort of process that it's gone through, I think open people's minds just to the fact of, like, oh, you know, a drug that was used to be assumed as this or scheduled as this can go through a rescheduling process and change. And so I think from just a drug policy change perspective, I think that opened people's awareness a little bit.
Our collective, I'm glad you brought up cannabis, because I feel like as our collective conscious experiences these new substances that are now becoming legal that were previously shunned, we in our mind will compare what we have now to what was just recently available. And so I think cannabis, there was this acceptance of it because I hear that people say it's better than being intoxicated on alcohol, it's better than SSRIs, and people tend maybe to lose sight of how it can cause and contribute to psychosis and scary panic attacks and weight gain and all the bad things that, you know, if you're really benefiting from it and you like that experience as a escape mechanism, I think it's very easy to overlook some of the drawbacks to it because we're so excited about it. Do you feel people compare psychedelics to other things as now these are like the safer alternative? Do you think that's a sound argument to make?
Yeah, I think people do. And I agree with you. I think we have to be very cautious of that as well. You know, I think cannabis, you know, especially I'm from Canada. And so cannabis has gone through a sort of interesting pathway in Canada. And then it's been interesting to watch what's happened in the United States. But, you know, to me, there's a little bit there of the cart getting a little bit ahead of the horse as well. You know, when the sort of regulation change conversation first came up in regards to cannabis, at least up in Canada, it was, oh, this, you know, has some medical promises and benefits to it, and that's why it should be made accessible. And then very, very quickly, that sort of flipped into more of a recreational sort of model. And what happened, unfortunately, with that is there just wasn't a lot of research that was done in regards to cannabis for a number of health indications. And I think that's unfortunate, because I do think we maybe lost the opportunity to highlight where cannabis can be useful for different health benefits. And instead, you know, it got more focused on recreational profit models and things like that. And then, you know, not only did cannabis become very widely accessible for people, but frankly, the products got, you know, quite bizarre and very powerful as
good
well.
Way of putting it.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, I definitely think that there's a lot to learn there from, you know, the path that cannabis has taken. And I think, again, with psychedelics, it's much maybe less of a case of how do we get psychedelic therapy to as many people as possible, as fast as possible. And I think the focus really needs to be how do we ensure the best outcomes for people and as possible in the beginning, knowing that there is such a large demand that's out there, but let's make sure that we're able to contribute to and make good on, you know, the representations that we've continued to make with research and now moving into more accessible clinical practice.
Hmm. Interesting. So we've talked quite a bit in this episode about historical shifts and acceptance and how to use ketamine safely, properly. Where do you see things going down the road? Mm. What does the future hold for us? And when do you have any speculation as to when psilocybin and MDMA might get approval from the FDA? I've always keep hearing every time somebody says a date, it's like usually 3 months from the present date.
Yeah. You know, And hopefully I don't jinx it, and hopefully we don't have to stretch out the date another 3 to 6 months. But we've worked really closely with MAPS over the last number of years. And, you know, they're at a very exciting point. As I mentioned, their second phase three is complete. We're waiting for the readout results of those, which should be last I heard is sometime late summer, early fall. So we're kind of expecting in the sort of next 30 to 90 days. And they anticipate, you know, sort of early or late spring, early summer of next year, the FDA approving MDMA assisted therapy. And so when I think about that, for us, I think the biggest challenge we have at the moment is training. And we've spoken a lot about, you know, making sure that these different compounds are being used in a good way. And training is really the way that we ensure that. And, you know, there's such a huge, we have huge amounts of people calling us daily asking, you know, when can I get access to MDMA assisted therapy? When can I get access to psilocybin assisted therapy? And, you know, the demand is so large, but training people takes time, and it's not something you can do in a weekend. It's not a kind of just bolt on thing that you do. And so I think the next 12 months, not just the next 12 months, but really continuing thereafter. But I think there's a lot of training that's needed to be provided. And that's another area that Numinous has spent a lot of time and resources towards is training. And we offer a host of different training programs for people. But I think that's going to be imperative, that not only do we offer training to as many people who are looking for access to training, but we offer good training. And there's a very big difference between the two. And that's going to be, you know, as I look towards the future, I think that's going to be really important to get prepared for MDMA assisted therapy in particular.
So the training is geared towards clinicians who are interested in utilizing that modality. Is it a certification that they get after completing your training, and how do they go about finding that?
Yeah. So if you go on our website, we do offer some kind of certification pathways, primarily obviously around ketamine assisted therapy at the moment, but we also do have training for MDMA and psilocybin assisted therapy. We actually most recently announced a partnership with MAPS to be able to offer experiential training with MDMA through a training trial that we'll be launching in the latter half of this year. We're just waiting for approval on that. But so that's something that we do offer and will continue to. Just to kind of get back to your other question, I think psilocybin, you know, MDMA will probably get a lot of the attention over the next 12 months. Psilocybin is probably a year or so behind that. But obviously what's interesting about psilocybin is it's kind of going a little bit of a more unique regulatory pathway as well. You've had states like Oregon and now Colorado just move to a legal access model for psilocybin-assisted therapy, which I think is really important for people to know. This is not a recreational framework for psilocybin. It's a therapeutic framework for it. So you could see access start to broaden maybe quickly and maybe a little bit more uniquely with psilocybin.
So would that fall into a similar status as cannabis, where federally it's still Schedule One, but on a state level, they're not going to enforce restrictions, at least for the clinical aspects of it?
That seems to be the case for the time being, although psilocybin is in clinical trials as well. There's a couple of different organizations, Compass Pathways being one, who has completed a phase two, and they've now launched their phase three clinical trials for psilocybin for NDD. And we're actually the clinical trial sites for some of that research work that's happening. So you could see kind of two pathways there. One is kind of the state-by-state availability of psilocybin-assisted therapy in the short term, while, you know, clinical trials are being completed and FDA approval happens for psilocybin in the next couple of years. MDMA is an FDA process, so that will be an FDA change, not just a state-by-state change.
Cool.
Yeah.
I appreciate all that insight. Do you have any other thoughts about future directions of mental health care, mental health treatment as a whole, given the theme of the podcast show? Or
I think what psychedelics again represent is this idea of curative intent. And, you know, that means different things for different people. And certainly, you know, that call it healing journey is one that representation of curative intent. It's a lifelong commitment to continuing to be dedicated to, whether it's practices or different modalities, to continue to ensure your mental wellness continues to stay strong. And I think maybe what we're continuing to shift more towards is the idea of, yes, curative intent for really severe mental health indications, but also shifting the conversation and landscape to one of mental wellness and preventative mental health care. We shouldn't have to wait until we're anxious or depressed or suicidal or addicted to start taking care of our mental health. And that's really, you know, a big hope for us is that we, you know, we start to move and shift and frankly allocate resources to, you know, being more preventative with how we treat and think about mental health care. You know, dentistry is an interesting one. Everybody goes, you know, as long as you have good dental care, you go to the dentist, you know, once or twice a year, even if you have perfect teeth. We should treat our mental health the same way, dedicated and caring about how our mental health is doing. And again, not waiting until it's, you know, something that's more severe in order to start to do something about it.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I'm thinking back to my childhood experiences in elementary school and thinking about how, you know, gym and recess and our physical health is so well incorporated into our curriculum. We talk about nutrition and the food pyramid and eating healthy. And we don't really talk about, there was no course on mental health and how to express emotions, unfortunately. But maybe that should start to change in the future to give it a little bit more weight and attention that it deserves, because obviously it plays a big impact on people's lives later on in their lives.
Agreed.
Well, Peyton, it was really nice talking to you about this topic. I appreciated both the microscopic and macroscopic conversation here about the landscape of psychedelics in general, both at Numinous and across the country and Canada as well, the continent, I should say. And it was a really nice conversation. I appreciate your company's thoughtful approach to psychedelic assisted therapy so that we can take a more judicious and cautious approach to trying to balance helping the most number of patients, but also not unnecessarily adding to any stigma about things that we don't know enough information about.
Yeah.
So, agreed. Well, and that's pretty cool that you also offer the training programs to clinicians as well. I wasn't aware of that. So hopefully any clinicians who are interested in that can click the link in the description and find more information about that if they're interested in taking that training course.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Sounds great.